Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Meander Mile, episode 6, of which we're going to be covering Dean Street. If you've listened to the previous episode, I covered Wardour Street, which is the street just to the west of us. Today I'm doing Dean Street, which basically goes from Oxford Street down to Shaftesbury Avenue, and to my left-hand side is going to be Frith Street, which we'll do next week. So this isn't a regular episode for new listeners. This is just a kind of an episode that I'm putting out while I'm doing the research for the rest of the season. So if you want to join in, you're welcome to just listen to the episode, or if you go to it, there's a link in the show notes, and what that'll do, that'll show you loads of pictures, which shows you all the locations that we're looking at. There's also a Google Maps street view that you can look at, and you can actually follow the route if you want to. Or if you're really crazy, you can actually come to Soho, stand on the, I'm currently on the corner of Dean Street and Carlisle Street, and follow the route as I walk it. It's actually quite a nice morning today. It's a bank holiday morning. When I recorded the last one, it was the first start of the Saturday on the bank holiday. It was a bit of a mess out there. Everyone was kind of drunk by about 1 o'clock. Guys were tottering along, puking everywhere. Ladies were wearing kind of their worst outfits. It's weird. It's almost as if they'd kind of locked them away in the cupboard for a year and a half, and then pulled them out and thought, oh, that looks classy. They didn't look classy anymore. I think people, after a year of wearing pyjamas, have forgotten how to be stylish and classy. Anyway, it'll take us a while to get used to it, won't it? So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're ready to start, let's kick off. Don't forget, you can go onto a link in the show notes underneath. It will show you all the pictures, and there's kind of a map as well. But I'm currently on the corner of Dean Street and Carlisle Street, just off Oxford Circus. So if we have a little look to our left, just to the left of Pizza Pilgrims, you will see a black door. This is a door that we've been to before, in episode 94, which was the Terror of Maltese London. If you remember that one, that was one of those episodes where I kind of dug in and thought, oh, do you know, everyone always talks about gangsters and how they're all feared and respected and how everything they do is kind of amazing and brilliant. But actually, when you look into the truth of their pasts, what they are is actually quite scared people. They're quite terrified of kind of being usurped by other people. And this was a prime example. So this was on Tuesday, the 5th of June, 1948, in the basement. There was a Maltese kind of gambling den in there. Two brothers had kind of been harassed. They were called the Farrugia brothers. They'd been harassed by a local gangster called Amabile Rica, who apparently word had got around that he was that he'd murdered a man over in Malta. And everyone was absolutely terrified of him, and word got around that he was absolutely horrific. He carried a gun, and everyone was in fear for their lives. But actually, when I looked into his past, it turned out he'd been messing around with a gun with his friend. He'd shot his friend in his leg, and he was actually charged with discharging a weapon in a public place. He actually served a couple of months. So actually, he wasn't a murderer, but being gangsters, they like to play on the myth, and therefore everyone around these streets all believe that he was the Terror of Maltese London. Have a look in the press, you'll see the pictures. It says Terror of Maltese London, but he wasn't really. Actually, one of the listeners who's actually related to Amabile Rica, very kindly, I can't distribute it because I've promised to keep it a secret, but they actually sent me a picture of Amabile Rica, and he is exactly not what I thought he would look like. He's entirely different from the descriptions that I was given at the time, that everyone kind of said he was big and large and scary. He wasn't. He looks like a regular chap. He actually looks quite decent as well. So that's slightly fascinating. The perception between who people really are and what they really are. So that was number three. We're still on the junction of Dean Street and Carlisle Street at the moment. So if you take an immediate left, immediate right, and you look straight ahead right, you will see a very tall white building with a kind of a weird sculpture on it that looks like a kind of an angel. That is 17 Carlisle Street. That was originally Carlisle House. This is a store we only just discovered a couple of days ago, but I think it's kind of interesting and quite... It's interesting in a way that when we do look at murder in the streets of London, and especially Soho, we kind of forget that actually we've got the Blitz. I've mentioned about it a lot in Murder Mile, but actually we forget that actually the Blitz was a daily event, especially across the first 150 days of the war. That was pretty much Blitz every single day, which is why it was called a Blitz. Many deaths on every street. So here's a little story that I discovered recently that I thought I'd tell you about, which happened at Carlisle House, number 17 Carlisle Street, which is why that building exists there today, but it actually replaced something else. So on the 11th of May 1941, at about 12:45 a.m., Carlisle Street, literally where we are now, was hit by a single high explosive bomb. It's unsure whether it was a 500 kilo bomb or whether there was two of them. Don't forget, this is the Blitz. There's lots of bombs going off, and there's still unexploded bombs being found today. The explosion tore through the western end of Carlisle Street. So basically, from where we are now, literally this side of Carlisle Street, backside of Nellie Dean down there, and if you're going down Dean Street, it's literally right down past St Anne's Court. So it's a real... We'll get there eventually. I'll show you where St Anne's Court is and the Richmond buildings, but basically all of those were decimated, which, when you look at it, it explains why there's so many facades to the building that are still there, but there's very few original buildings that are still there. Basically, Carlisle House, which is this building, 17 Carlisle Street, right to the right, was entirely demolished. It was an elegant 18th century city mansion that was originally the home of the British Board of Film Censors from 1936, so they'd actually only been there a couple of years. BBFC, as most people know, are now on Soho Square, just to our left. That night, during the bombing, City of Westminster ARP, who were the air raid wardens, lost two colleagues who were on fire watching duty in Carlisle House. George Frederick Hydes, who was 42 years old and was an air raid warden, and his son Martin Roger Hydes, who was 14 and he was an ARP messenger. Both of them were in 17 Carlisle Street at the moment. They were also living there as well. It turns out that 14-year-old Martin Hyde, he was actually evacuated before the Blitz actually started, the full extent of the Blitz. He was evacuated out into the country because he was a young boy, but his parents missed him so much that they wanted him to come back home. So he returned back home to Soho. He was living in 17 Carlisle Street with his dad because they're ARP wardens. They had a space there. Unfortunately, that's exactly where the bomb hit, and they were both killed that day. In total, six people were trapped in the rubble. And there was also a gentleman called Warden Summers who was also killed as well, along with another messenger boy who apparently was standing in the doorway at the time that the bombings happened, and he was killed outright. So I think that's one of those little stories that kind of we forget happens. I think we just accept that, you know, the air raids happened, there was lots of death and destruction, and we always see pictures of buildings blown up, but I think we often forget that in there is people with real lives. I'm going to tell you another story now. This is actually on the left-hand side of the street. So we haven't even moved from the corner of Carlisle Street and Dean Street at the moment. We're still in the same place, which is very, very handy. So if you look to your left, you will see that is Soho Square. Where you see all the trees, that is Soho Square. Interestingly, underneath Soho Square is a huge air raid shelter. The entrance to that is actually on this side of the street. No one really knows much about it. It is still there. I think, obviously, some people have tried to turn it into a restaurant because it's, you know, space in London is at a premium, but I think there's a real problem with air conditioning down there and light and, you know, there's restrictions. Anyway, corner of Carlisle Street, the far eastern side and the corner of the Soho Square. This happened on the 5th of January, 1817, so quite more than 200 years ago. An incredibly poor lady who was called Margaret Thatcher, not that one, not our former Prime Minister, a different one. If you can appreciate 1817, this was an era before any kind of national health service. Basically in the era, if you couldn't afford to hire a doctor, you didn't get well, you just got sick. Thank God for the NHS. Margaret Thatcher, now no one really knows much about her, no one really knows her age. It was kind of hard to determine how old she was. But a gentleman came across her and she seemed very emaciated, very sick. She seemed to have had several different types of cancers. She was unable to feed or clothe herself, and she was found slumped in the gutter. She was still alive at the time. According to him, he said she had some kind of wasting disease. So she was so emaciated, they really didn't know what age she was. They know very little about her, to be honest. What we do know is that she came from St. Giles in the Rookery, which, as we've mentioned before, the Rookery is literally just over the street. That's that incredibly poor part of town where all the slums were, right at the back of the Horseshoe Brewery. So if you remember when the Horseshoe Brewery, the vat exploded and it flooded all those houses and people drowned, that is the Rookery, one of the poorest parts of this area. And this area was incredibly poor. Now, over the other side of Soho Square is the church over there. And they actually have a watch house on it. It was built in 1801. It was actually a shelter for the man who protected the graveyard, because there was a lot of grave robbing going on around that time, which we'll dive into very shortly. The watchman there, his name was John Pert. He said on the Friday night about 9 o'clock, he was going about his rounds and he saw the lady sitting upon the steps of Mr. Park's doorway in Carlisle Street, which is apparently it's number 3, so it's just at the end. He asked what was the matter. She said that she was very ill and very cold. As you can appreciate, I think it's winter there, isn't it? Isn't it January? Yeah, height of January, so she's absolutely freezing. He asked if she knew anyone in the house. She was like, no. So they knocked on the door. They said, can you get some hot water and something? And they did. They gave her a gin to kind of help revive her. She was still struggling. And he was like, okay, the workhouse is literally opposite where the church is. They're going to take her into the church, into the workhouse, so at least she can get a kind of a parish doctor who's there and kind of a bed and something to eat and hopefully try and revive her. The watchman came along. He had a gentleman of the workhouse to kind of pick her up, and they'd basically taken her over Soho Square towards the church, and that is probably about 300 feet. Unfortunately, by the time they got her to the workhouse, she was so sick, she was so emaciated, that they didn't know that she'd actually died. She was unable to kind of walk herself. They were kind of carrying her kind of feet, dragging a little bit, kind of doing kind of half steps. By the time she got there, she was already dead. The problem was, even the doctor said that by the time they got her there, she was so emaciated and sick and pale and cold, even he didn't know at that point if she was still alive or not. Do you know, some people said she was alive, some people said she was dying, some people said she was dead. Unfortunately, she was already dead. There was an inquest into her death, which was held at the Golden Lion pub, which is at the bottom of Dean Street, that we'll visit very shortly. This is an era where even like late 1800s, many inquests and court cases were being held in pubs. And quite often, if there was an inquest into a murder, they would bring the body from the from the hospital into the pub, so that people could kind of look at it. Do you know who were the jury on the coroner's courts and the criminal trials? At the inquest into the death of Margaret Thatcher, they said this is on the court records. Said her death was determined that she had died by visitation of God. So what they're saying is basically natural causes. It's quite a sad story. I think that's kind of, as we know, quite a perfect kind of Murder Mile story. The one that we've heard many times about hardship in life. Just moving us down a little bit further now. We are walking down Dean Street. I've just passed the Nellie Dean pub, a very nice pub. Might pop in for a little socially distanced pint later on. I say socially distanced, it's just me by myself. Of course it's going to be socially distanced. Just passing a little phone box here, and on my right hand side you will see St. Anne's Court, which is a court going down. That is kind of our route down to Wardour Street just there. Now, I stumbled across this by accident a couple of days ago. Trying to find out more about this case, but unfortunately there's very little information that's actually concrete out there. So, on the corner of where I am now, Dean Street and St. Anne's Court, this was on, believed to be September 1971. The fingers of a right hand were found in the street. They said they were possibly from a male adult. It looked as if they had been removed with possibly bolt cutters. The pathologist said that it was a relatively blunt instrument. It wasn't anything sharp like a butcher's knife. It'd been snipped, it hadn't been sliced. The owner was never unknown, and it was never determined why they were there or actually who they belonged to. Maybe it was an accident, maybe it was a DIY accident from a builder, maybe it was gang related, maybe they were stolen from a hospital or a morgue, and you know, maybe someone misplaced them, we don't know. But someone's fingers were found in the street, and we don't know why. A nice little story there. Hopefully you're having your breakfast at the moment, you're going, lovely, I was just tucking into some lovely sausages and now you don't want to. Just so you know, remember I mentioned that the World War II bomb had actually blasted out the Richmond buildings. So if you're looking at St. Anne's Court, the Richmond buildings are the buildings just beyond that on the right-hand side. So all of this area was basically blown out, except for the facades on the front of the buildings were still intact, and many of them have kind of survived or been recouped, but the back ends of the houses were kind of badly demolished. Right now I'm standing in front of 14 Dean Street, which is on the left hand side. It's a very kind of a vague brown building with a kind of a, it's easy to spot, it's the NatWest building. Not the NatWest building, it's just actually NatWest Bank. This is number 14 Dean Street. This is believed to be where the location is. I'm currently digging in deep into the story at the moment, so this might not be exactly where it happened, but this next story is going to be coming soon to Murder Mile, so when I've done my research, you will get a full episode on this. So this murder happened 22nd of October 1963, so that's exactly 1 month before the assassination of JFK. 21-year-old Margaret Ann Haldane of Iberian Avenue over in Croydon. She was a typist over at the War Office. She was stabbed to death in a crowded Soho Street, literally here where we are now, by someone using a chef's knife. This description is kind of endemic of kind of the era that we're in at the moment. It was kind of 1960s. It was said she was seen talking to a young coloured man. When you look at the press, this is basically all they seem to latch onto. It's that kind of era. Outside of a block of flats on Dean Street, suddenly she fell, clutching at the railings in front of the offices as she crumpled onto the pavement. A man, he was 6 foot 1 inches tall, described as, here we go, black or Latin. Yeah, I'll just let that hang there. Don't forget, this is an era where basically you could just turn around and say someone was foreign, and that's enough, that makes him suspicious. Apparently he's wearing heavy dark rimmed spectacles and a chocolate brown suit, and he ran off in the direction of Piccadilly Circus, which is basically straight ahead, really. Anne was said to be lying on the pavement, surrounded by literally hundreds of people. The street was sealed off, and she was taken to the Middlesex Hospital, which is over in Fitzrovia. It's not too far away. It's actually where the workhouse of where Charlie Chergwin died. That's just over the road. Apparently, she had wounds to her chest and stomach, and she'd been stabbed in the heart. She died en route to the hospital, which is literally 2 minutes away. So this is almost 60 years on. And this is one of those murders that hasn't been solved. So I'm doing some more research on that. And that episode, the unsolved murder of Margaret Haldane, or Anne Margaret Haldane, will be coming to Murder Mile, hopefully soon. Maybe this year, I don't know. I've kind of prepped a lot of episodes for this year. Right, deep breath, everyone. It's nice doing this today. It's not too busy on the streets. the other day. I think you could probably hear how busy it was on the other episode. It was really messy and noisy. I actually had a second recorder in my spare hand and had it kind of behind me so I could record the sounds of the street to kind of make it a better kind of audio quality for you. But in the end, it just messed everything up. But now, it's nice. I think you can actually hear a taxi about to go past. See, couldn't have heard that the other day. People walking by, it's nice and quiet. It is actually only about, it's 11:30 on a bank holiday Monday morning, so it's actually quite nice. I think people have got hangovers. Yeah, damn right. So let's go back to an episode that we have covered before. So if we go into the end of the where the NatWest Bank building is, just past the cash point, and if you look on your right-hand side, you will see a building called 82 Dean Street, which is called Honey Poke. Good name, Honey Poke. It's kind of a very vague, kind of greyish building. It looks like very 1960s. Ugh, looks a bit horrible. But if you remember correctly, this is the location of the murder of Big Al, who was murdered by Richard Rhodes Henley. Taking us back to episode 16, Richard Rhodes Henley, the seaman and the porn peddler. I think one of my favourite episodes. Back then, 82 Dean Street was a... it was described as a bookshop, but as we know, it wasn't really a bookshop. It was an adult bookshop, which meant pornography. Well, that's what Soho's all about. So Richard Rhodes Henley was 26 years old. He was a leading seaman in the Canadian Navy. He was a chef and a chronic masturbator. Unfortunately, someone just walked past right then when I had to say the words chronic masturbator. They're probably wondering what I'm doing. The adult bookshop. So there's a bin truck going past. It's going to be noisy. See, if this was a regular episode of Murder Mile, that truck would go past when I wasn't talking, because I edit them in especially. That went past right in the middle of a bloody sentence. Anyway, if you remember the pawn shop that was there, it was ran by a gentleman called Big Al. He was actually called John Allen Dixon Robinson. Good name. On the morning of Saturday, the 27th of October, 1956, Richard Rhodes Henley arrived here outside the pawn shop. He wanted to pick up pornography. If you remember, he had an addiction to pornography. He couldn't look at the same pornographic image twice. These were the era of glossies as well. So printed photos and 16mm films. He waited there. The place didn't open up until 9. He went in there and he's like, I've ordered all this pornography. And Big Al was like, yeah, no problem, come into the back room. He had to package them up into big boxes. And then Big Al, he put them under his arm. He's like, okay, where's my money? It was about £7,000. And Richard Rhodes Henley didn't have the money. He shot Big Al to death. And as mentioned in the previous episode, St. Anne's Court is literally where they went running down that street. Richard Rhodes Henley on his crutches, and if I remember, I think it was Stanley and Albert who were literally chasing them behind. The old bloke and the asthmatic. Anyway, you know all about that episode. You can check that one out. I'm going to tell you something that you won't know. So, on your left-hand side, we're walking down just a little bit further, 21 Dean Street, you will see the Soho Theatre. Nice theatre. It does kind of good theatre pieces, but good comedy as well. And actually, it does good beers as well. So this is 21 Dean Street. This is not really a murder, but just something I found that was amusing that I thought I'd fill you in on. June 1943, so height of World War II, a drunken French commando and an RAF airman were marched into a police station over at Tottenham Court Road. They'd been found slumped in the street by an air raid warden, absolutely arseholed, been drinking all day. Apparently, they'd been setting off bombs which had shattered buildings in Dean Street. So basically here, 21 Dean Street, where this was, immediately opposite the Richmond buildings. At first, the warden thought that they were dead, but when he woke them up, apparently they're all slurring, and they asked him for a match. He asked why, because they didn't seem to have any cigarettes on them, and they said because they wanted to set off another bomb. Apparently they were drunk and they were having a lovely time. Apparently they were taken to the police station, and even when they went to the police station, they said to the detective sergeant who was there, can I have a match? And the detective sergeant said, why? And they were like, bombs, I'm a commando, I know how to use them. Lovely. What a lovely story. So apparently they were in Soho, they were bored, they had some explosives with them, and they thought, well, there's not enough destruction going on, I'll just go and blow up everything. Lovely. Just in front of the Richmond buildings there, I know it's all looking nice, and ahead is the Soho Hotel ahead. Very nice, very posh, very expensive. I just thought I'd throw this little story in there. I was once walking past this area before, and there was a crack addict in the street, as there always is in Soho, and he was having a big dump right in the middle of the street in daylight. And what I found out, because I was like, oh, this is weird, I seem to find a lot of people having defecating in the streets. What is going on? Because there is toilets you can use. Apparently, crack bungs you up. Apparently, if you take crack, it does something to your stomach and it kind of bungs you up, and it makes it really difficult for you to defecate. So a lot of crack addicts actually suffer from really bad piles, anal bleeding, and prolapses. You wanted to know that, didn't you? Yeah, of course you did. This is all the useful facts that you wanted to know about. Just moving ahead now, walking further south down Dean Street, just past Japes. And on the left-hand side, you will see some big Union Jack flags. And that is a building called Quo Vadis. This isn't murder related, but I just thought, you know, it's Soho related, so I'll throw this in there. Quo Vadis was actually the... Hang on, let me go down a bit on my notes. Yes, I'm using notes. I have to, because there's so much to remember here. Karl Marx actually settled in London in 1849 and remained in the city until his death, until 1833. Now, if you look up on the building on the second floor, you'll see a blue plaque. Karl Marx at 28 Dean Street in Soho, this is where he worked on the first volume of Das Kapital. Apparently, when he was living there, he was incredibly poor. He was ragged. It looked like an absolute mess. Looked like he was homeless. But this literally was where he lived. And that's where he wrote the first version of Das Kapital. Very useful. Just scrolling down a little bit more now. We're just going to go. You've got Delane Lee on the right-hand side. You've got a very good pub on the left-hand side called the Crown and Two Chairmen on the corner of Bateman Street. But the building I want to focus on, I'm just waiting until I get there so you can see it. Oh, that's where Royalty House is. There we go. So number 72, Royalty House on the left-hand side. That's immediately on the junction of Bateman Street and on Dean Street. It's literally on the corner. So there'll be a story that almost certainly all of you have heard of, and that is Burke and Hare. So Burke and Hare were the body snatchers in Edinburgh. They're pretty much famous. They killed a total of 16 people and sold their bodies to the anatomist Dr. Robert Knox for dissection. If you can appreciate, this is the door. Okay, that seems to be my catchphrase on this, isn't it? If you can appreciate. Of course you can appreciate. This was the dawn of dissection. There was an influx of medical schools popping up, and what they needed was bodies to examine. There was a really high demand, but there was a really short supply of good quality bodies for them to examine. You can't just... They can't just take someone who's been dead for a long time. They need the bodies as fresh as possible. Therefore, an industry cropped up referred to as the resurrection men. So, obviously in Edinburgh we have Burke and Hare, but in London we had the resurrection men, who are not very much is kind of said about them, but this actually, I would say they're more infamous. So they were John Bishop, together with, not John Bishop the comedian, a different one, obviously, John Bishop, together with Thomas Williams, Michael Shields, who was a Covent Garden porter. I mentioned him in the Covent Garden episode, as well as James May, who was an unemployed butcher. Basically, they would go around stealing fresh bodies, but also murdering homeless young men and using them, because if they're missing, who's going to really report them? One of those bodies was actually delivered here, so 72 Dean Street. Back in this era, this was 1830s, 72 Dean Street was the Dean Street Medical School, ran by Joseph Carpew, who was an English surgeon at the time, and was very keen into kind of dissection and learning from bodies. November 1830, Bishop of May spoke to Joseph Carpue in his lecture theatre, surrounded by around several students present, who all wanted to know how fresh, this is their words, the thing was. That's how they referred to this young homeless boy that actually they'd come across and they'd murdered. Carpue offered to pay 8 guineas, which was a good price, and Bishop agreed to deliver the body later that morning at 10 o'clock. That's how kind of standard this was. They were going around, they were murdering young men, they were delivering the bodies to medical establishments. Obviously, you know, these medical establishments, they needed bodies, so they were looking the other way. As long as they didn't ask questions and say, where did this young man come from, they just didn't care. It's unsure who the young boy was that they delivered. Apparently he was only about 11 years old. Many of them were homeless young boys found living on the streets who were hungry and broke. And these men would kind of lure them in with promises of kind of food and work. They would murder them. They would normally murder them through suffocation. They obviously they couldn't strangle them, because if you strangle them, therefore there would be marks on the neck. Couldn't stab them because there'd be stab wounds. And therefore, the doctor in charge of the medical facility would have to ask the question, what happened? What happened to this young boy? Whereas if they suffocate them, you could just say, well, I found, you know, it's winter, I found him dead on the streets. And they, you know, therefore, their body hasn't been reported missing. Therefore, no one knows that they're missing. Therefore, there's no evidence of how they died, which is perfect for the medical schools. Now, even though Burke and Hare were charged with, apparently they killed and delivered 16 bodies, the London Resurrection Men, who were basically based in this area, but mostly East London, it is said that they murdered between 500 and 1,000 bodies. That's according to John Bishop. That he admitted that in his confession. So even to this day, we don't know exactly how many young men and boys they actually murdered. I'm just going to throw in a little break here in a bit. I forgot to do that in the other episode. Therefore, an advert probably creeps in a really awkward way. But I thought I'd end this first section with a little story. Ah, lovely. Just at the end of Bateman Street, so on your left-hand side, is a lovely little pub called the Dog and Duck. And this isn't murder related, I just thought I'd share this story with you. Back in 2001, when I was working as a runner in the film industry, when you were a runner, I was paid 30 quid a week, I was on pittance, but you get to do a lot of interesting jobs. We were working on a film with Ray Winston. My mate Ray Winston, the governor. Really good actor, really lovely bloke. We were working on the film and we knew that it was being put forward for loads of awards and things. So what the boss said, he was like, right, we need to film a kind of an intro for the awards. We're going to get Ray in there. We're going to do it in the upstairs for a pub, because it was a film about pubs. So they were like, Mike, can you use a camera and a boom mic? I was like, yeah. He was like, they were like, great. Director's going to have the camera. You can have the boom mic. So I got in there. It was a tiny little pub, like a room probably about 20 feet wide, if that. It was just me and the line producer. And the line producer said, oh, God, we can't be in a pub with Ray Winston and not have pints. I best get some pints in. So he ordered a pint. I had a pint. We started drinking. Turned out Ray was running late. The shoot he was on was overrunning, so, you know, things started getting delayed. The producer of the film turned up and said, hang on, are you guys not drinking? Because we'd finished our pints. And they were like, oh, God, if Ray turns up and thinks that Caesar's not drinking, he's going to think that we're really pathetic. So he was like, let's get the pints in. So that was my second pint. And then the director turned up. That was about half an hour later. Ray's still not there. His car's stuck in traffic. Director turns up and goes, are you guys not drinking? We'd finished our pints by that point. And he was like, God, you have to get some pints in, otherwise Ray's going to think we're pathetic. Third pint. By the time Ray turns up, his car's stuck in traffic. He turns up, really lovely guy, really sweet, plays the hard man, but he's got a heart of gold. Turned up, we'd all finished our pints. He was like, you boys not drinking? Best get the pints in. So by the time we started shooting this little promo for him, I was on my fourth pint. And you try holding a boom mic in the air when you've had four pints of beer. Yeah, not good. Anyway, just going to leave space here for a little break so we can pop in an advert so I can pay the bills. Enjoy.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Wait. Hey guys, welcome back to part two of Meander Mile, taking a little walk down Dean Street. I'm still outside the corner of the Crown of Two Chairmen, just on the corner of Bateman Street. I'm going to open us up with, that sounds weird, especially after we've just talked about the Resurrection Man. I'm going to open us up with a little story I stumbled across recently, just like the fingers that I mentioned just up the street. This is another one of those stories where I've caught glimpses of it. People who are local have told me about it, but I don't know much else about this. So this happened on the corner of Dean Street and Bateman Street. This was 1974. The date is unknown, but it is believed to be summer. Apparently, there was a flasher on this street, so a gentleman going around exposing himself to people. It's believed that he was a man. This is what makes it slightly difficult, is people have said it is believed that he was recently castrated. Whether that's for medical reasons, whether he did it himself, whether someone did that as a kind of a gang retribution, we don't know. But he was going around the streets flashing his lack of genitalia to passers-by. He was never caught, and he was never identified, so we really don't know who he is. Bit of an odd story, that one. Anyway, moving forwards, moving south down the street, and if you look on your left-hand side, is this the right one? Yes, it is. So you'll see red awnings on the outside, hopefully immediately opposite Maird Street. This is 36 to 38 Dean Street. This is a little restaurant called Lobster and Burger. Obviously, these are two buildings that have been kind of mashed together, but we're looking at 38 Dean Street. I found this in the newspapers recently. This was from an advert in the newspapers in 1832. So I'll read you this. Dr. E.D. of 38 Dean Street, Soho, by his own peculiar mode of treatment, has attained the preeminence for the cure of venereal disease, whether long-standing or otherwise, which he enjoys the gratitude numbers, meaning lots of people seem to like it. His serum or potion, this is in quotes, can perform miracles, not just evidence of truth, this means, i.e., making it work, to act consistent with consumption, rheumatism, dropsy, headaches, and nervous irritation, in many cases bordering on madness, as well as eruptions, meaning acne, pains in the limbs, obstinate gleets, I've no idea what obstinate gleets means, ulcerations, dimness of sight, nodes on the shin bones, ulceration of the throat, and venereal disease. It seems to be a bit of a wonder cure. So I couldn't really find out what it was actually that they were that he was peddling here. But apparently, if you've got VD and you've got access to a time machine, go back to the 1830s, go to 38 Dean Street, and apparently you've got a cure for pretty much everything. Pretty much everything. Just scrolling ahead a little bit further now, so you will see on the left-hand side, I'm gonna be a little bit quiet now because the restaurant is open. On the left-hand side is 40 Dean Street. It's a kind of a seven-story building, red brick, red on the outside, and there's a big sign on there that actually says 40. That's the name of the restaurant. It is 40 at 40 Dean Street. Imaginative, yes, I know. Now this isn't murder, but I just thought, you know, what I'm trying to do with Meander Mile is show you kind of things, interesting crimes that kind of happened in and around the area. And sometimes things that are just baffling, and it all just makes you just go, why did this actually happen? This happened on the 4th of June, 2013, so relatively new. Nima Safai, that's whose restaurant it was. It could still be today. It was a lovely little restaurant owned by celebrity chef Aldo Zilli. Now, apparently, Sam Buttery, 22, if you watch reality TV, you may know that name. He was a former finalist on BBC One's The Voice. I've never seen it myself, but that's that program where, you know, someone sings and the judges are facing the wrong way, and then they do something, and then there's a big reveal where they turn around and the chair spin round, and then you go, ooh, so that's what the person looks like. I hate it. I think it's utter dog shit. Anyway, Sam Buttery, 22, was a former finalist on The Voice. He was part of Tom Jones's, hello, Tom Jones, Tom Jones's team in the first series of the, inverted commas, popular BBC talent show. Apparently, he was walking along the street that day, 4th of June 2013, and it was said, drawing attention to himself when he sang It's Delovely by Cole Porter as he strolled past the restaurant. Apparently, the owner of the restaurant, Nima Safai, was really upset about that. Sam Buttery was livid when the owner hurled abuse at him and told him to go to the gym. Sam Buttery is a relatively large chap. I would say he's probably no bigger than me. He's probably likes a little bit of cake like I do. The singer who went on to star in the West End's Boy George musical Taboo retorted, "Don't you know who I am?" I'm just going to leave that there for a bit. You're a finalist in the freaking Voice, for God's sake. You're hardly a celebrity. Unfortunately, as we heard with the other episode, people who are in reality TV shows seem to have a highfalutin belief in themselves. Anyway, that's his decision. So that's what he said. He said, "Don't you know who I am?" He then threw the contents of a glass of champagne in Safai's face. Lovely. You really shouldn't do that. Safai then forcibly launched the champagne flute back at Mr. Buttery, causing a 6.5-inch wound to his head and a cut to his ear. The restaurant boss was jailed for 15 months at Southwark Crown Court after he was found guilty of one count of wounding without intent. Safai was then told he would also have to pay £4,000 compensation to Mr. Buttery, £2,000 costs, and a £120 victim surcharge. I never understand victim surcharge. It seems like a tip or victim tax. It's very odd. And his restaurant license was suspended for 16 months. Apparently after that, Sam Buttery, anxiety had really affected him by that point. He had to have plastic surgery on his ear and his cheek. And he is no longer performing. His agent has removed him from their records, and he's back in the West Midlands living with his mum, because it's apparently knocked his confidence so much. Odd story, that one. I thought I'd throw that one in. If we go down two doors down, on the left-hand side, you will see at 42 Dean Street, immediately opposite Bourchier Street, you will see K Tray, another little restaurant. We've been here before. This is from episode 122, Savas Dimitriadis and the Code of Silence. If you remember, that was about the two Cypriot gentlemen, Savas Dimitriadis and Christos Georgiou. They were long-term friends. They've been in the Navy for years as friends. They'd set up a little cafe over in Cardiff. But things changed in 1973. There was a bit of a falling out, as apparently, you know, £1.10 had gone missing from the till, and that kind of caused a rift between the two of them. They were no longer talking anymore. They'd split. They hadn't talked in about 6 months. What date was this? So Sunday, 24th of October, 1943. They hadn't spoke for about 6 months. Both of them were in Soho. Both of them were kind of chronic bettors. Soho was a place for kind of, you know, sex, drugs, drink, but also gambling as well. They both come here. This was, K-Trade was originally kind of a Greek Cypriot coffee shop that everyone who was Greek Cypriot kind of frequented. They both saw each other there. They decided, you know what, let's break bread. Let's not cause a scene here. Because when people saw them, they were like, oh my God, they're going to kick off. But they were like, no, come on, let's break bread. So they had a coffee. They started playing cards together. They had a laugh. They went out for a couple of drinks and everything seemed fine. Morning of Sunday, the 24th of October, 1943. Christos had a real massive hangover that day. He decided to go out to the pub. He started kept drinking even more, getting absolutely boozed up. He'd gone to the Coach and Horses over on Greek Street, really good pub, and was boozing and boozing. He came out south at Romilly Street and came north of Dean Street. And kind of as he approached the corner of Dean Street and Old Compton Street and turned left, if I remember, he was heading towards where Dodo is at the moment. That's when he saw Savas Dimitriadis. A fight broke out between them and he was, Savas was stabbed to death. If you remember, it's that catchphrase again. With that episode, obviously there was a code of silence where the Greek Cypriots would not talk to the police. Therefore, everyone was kind of like, no, we didn't see anything, even though it was in public street. But as soon as they realised how petty this little dispute was, suddenly everyone was like, you know what? Sod them. They don't deserve to be protected by us. Lovely little story. That's episode 122. Immediately opposite K-Tray is Bourchier Street. You see a little alley down there. We've been there before. This originally used to be Little Dean Street, but prior to that, it was Milk Alley, and that's where Mr. and Mrs. Birch lived, who were the... as I mentioned in the previous episode, they were kind of the early version of Fred and Rose West. They were the lovely couple who beat baby Richard to death. Unfortunately, it was that kind of era. Oh, I've got another one that I totally forgot about. I almost walked past it. So immediately opposite K-Tray, 65 Dean Street, you will see a white building and it's a Goldcrest Post-Production. I'm going to stand over here so I can go into the shadow so I can actually read this properly. Found this out a couple of days ago. This is just one of those sad little old ones that I found. Where this building was originally was 65 Dean Street. It's marked as 66 Dean Street now, but it's actually 65-66. 25th of June, 1877, at Marlborough Street Police Court, Henry Hall, a bootmaker of 65 Dean Street, was charged with attempting to poison his wife and three children with laudanum, which is an alcoholic solution containing morphine and opium. And it was used quite a lot in that era as a painkiller, but also kind of as a sedative as well. Apparently he was broken, he was unemployed, he was hungry, he was in a fit of depression. He didn't think he could go through with life and he didn't want his wife and children to have to put up with anything anymore, so he purchased the laudanum so he could kind of poison his children and, you know, let them drift off into a kind of the peaceful beyond. Unfortunately, he was so poor he couldn't afford enough laudanum, so he kind of had enough for his wife and enough for his children, but it just wasn't enough. It made them sleepy, but it didn't actually drug them. The neighbor came round, saw the children kind of collapsed on the floor, took them to a doctor who was nearby. Saw the bottle next to them, so he knew exactly what it was, revived the children. So in the end, thank God, he ended up not killing his wife and three children. Henry Hall was found guilty. Apparently, they describe him as a man of good character. He was found guilty and was sentenced to 15 years penal servitude, which means hard labour. But he wasn't deported overseas. It's amazing, isn't it? 15 years, that's a hell of a long time. And you know, in that era as well, there would have been none of this half-time off for good behaviour and all that crap, he would have been 100% in prison for that 15 years. Sorry, I was just trying to find myself a little bit of shadow here, or shade, because it's gone bloody hot. So if we walk down Dean Street a little bit further, on the right-hand side, you'll see a red awning that says Tom Cossey. And then you will see a grey building. Then you'll see Prowler, which does kind of leather gear for homosexual gentlemen. Lovely. I'm going to pop in there later on and buy some lovely spandex stuff. Oh, exciting. I'm not. Fat man in spandex? No. But if you look on the right-hand side, you'll see a very grey building with kind of brown brick above, very tall. That is 61 Dean Street. So next to the grey building, you'll see a little tiny doorway in between. It's green, it's got loads of graffiti on it. It's a little doorway. That is 61 Dean Street, and it leads to a building behind 62 Dean Street. Sorry, that's very confusing, but it's the way it's set up here. So that little doorway there, anyone who knows Soho knows that that's kind of one of the brothels that's known in that area. Why? Because the signs are on the outside that say models upstairs. It's unashamed. You can walk, not that I know, you can walk in there, you take into 62, that's a series of flats behind, and basically you can have sex with prostitutes. Lovely. Anyway, this is a story that happened not too long ago. This is January the 28th, 2017. At 61 Dean Street, so it would have been through those doors. A young gentleman, well, not really young, Kevin Bainbridge, 32, of Braintree in Essex. He went to the brothel for the purposes of sex, obviously. Obviously, otherwise why else would you go there? He paid £70 for sex. When he got there, he wasn't really in the mood for it. This seems a bit of a weird story. Apparently, the victim said the sex worker felt really sorry for him. He'd paid £40 for sex, but he sat on the end of the bed and indicated that he did not want to have sex, but that he just wanted to have a hug. She gave him a hug, and both of his arms were around him, and she allowed him to put his head on her neck. Mr. Bainbridge only had one arm around her. She gave him a cuddle with both arms, as mentioned. At this point, he pulled out a large kitchen knife and slashed her. He caused superficial wounds to her abdomen. She was screaming. Apparently there's a pimp in the building who was meant to protect them. But the door had been closed on the outside, so he couldn't get in. Bainbridge at that point decided that he was going to leave. He got up, he dropped the knife on the floor. The front door had been locked, he couldn't get out, and therefore he was immediately arrested. Apparently, he'd brought the knife from a Sainsbury's store earlier that day, and when he pulled it out, it was still in the packaging he'd bought it in. So he'd obviously gone there with some kind of intent to cause harm to this woman who he clearly didn't know. He admitted one count of causing grievous bodily harm. Caroline Gassman, who was the prosecutor, said right from the beginning on the first hearing, he has expressed his remorse. This is someone who was calm, awaiting for the police. He didn't know what he had done. The judge said there was a substantial degree of planning and premeditation, as you armed yourself with a very dangerous weapon. He was sent to prison for 4 years. So when was that? 2014, so he'll probably be out by now. Anyway, that was a lovely, cheerful story. I'm going to stroll down a little bit further. So immediately opposite 62, you will see a green awning, and this is on 45 Dean Street. So I should have said at the start, these street numbers are really cockeyed. It starts at the top on the left-hand side and goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, down to the 50s, and then it goes up the other side. It's very confusing. But 45 Dean Street, this is the Groucho Club. Now, it's a bit of a pretentious club. Unfortunately, I've been there. It's full of media types. I've been there a couple of times before. I find it really dull. It's full of lovies. It's just, people seem to like it, but I really don't understand why. Anyway, Groucho Club. 45 Dean Street, originally, if you go back to the 1920s, 1930s, This was the headquarters of Billy Hill. Billy Hill was a gangster connected with smuggling, protection rackets and extreme violence. He was one of the foremost perpetrators of organised crime in London from the 1920s through to the 1960s. His gang managed cash robberies in and he defrauded London's high society of millions of pounds at the card tables of John Aspinall's Claremont Club. I'm probably not going to dive into that story in Murder Mile because you know me and gangsters, I find them to be full of bullshit. Billy Hill, he will crop up in an episode coming up soon. Billy Hill was Britain's first celebrity gangster. Apparently he was termed as the King of Soho, but if you've been on Murder Mile Walks, you know that loads of people are described as the King of Soho and they're not. He joined up with Jack Spot, who we will hear about on an episode coming up soon, and took over basically the city's gambling and protection rackets. From here, these were his Dean Street headquarters. He also, if you go back to the Chinatown episode, he also had another office down in Chinatown. Billy Hill was the mentor to the twins Ronnie and Reggie Cray, who unfortunately you will be hearing on a lot on an advert that I'm promoting at the moment. Sorry guys, I need the money. He advised them during their early criminal careers. Ah, that was exciting. So I'm moving on a little bit further. I'm going to go to the corner of Old Compton Street and Dean Street. So on my left-hand side is Joe and the Juice, which is a juice establishment, and on the right is Prowler, where you can get all of your leather goods. Treat yourself, ladies and gentlemen. It's funny, on the window out front, it's got lots of gentlemen who are clearly buff and do lots of exercise. And I think the idea is to say to people, hey, if you buy spandex pants, you're going to look this good. And it's like, come on, guys. It's not. It's like the only time any of us look good is when we're wearing something that's black. If we wear anything else that looks white, it shows up how wobbly we are. Unfortunately, I'm a very wobbly person, which is no bad thing. Eva likes that. So I'm on the corner, as mentioned, of the corner of Old Compton Street and Dean Street at the moment. Just to my right-hand side, you'll see a blue building with a flag outside. That's the Admiral Duncan Pub, where the bombing happened in 1999, back in April. Just beyond that, from the last week's episode, is there's a white building down there, 66 Old Compton Street. That's where Dutch Lair was murdered. But I took us deliberately to this corner at the moment, because if we go back to episode 20, the bungled assassination of Alexander Litvinenko. If you remember that episode, I've done that again. It's that phrase again. I'm gonna stop myself saying that. The Russian spies, assassins Andrei Lugovoy and Dmitry Kovtun, they'd come to Soho. Obviously, they were planning to murder Alexander Litvinenko by getting the highly radioactive polonium-210, tipping it into his tea, because obviously he was teetotal, poisoning him, and then they could disappear out of the country before he gets ill. But being the cunning assassins that they are, you know, undercover, trying to make it low-key, from that episode, they came to Soho. They went to the Piccadilly Hotel, which is literally just around the corner, 65 Shaftesbury Avenue. It was formerly called the Shaftesbury, a four-star hotel. Before the murder, what they decided to do, they decided to dress for their night out in Soho. I'm going to read a passage from that episode, if you don't mind. It says, rather than adopting anonymous black suits to help them blend seamlessly into the city, Kovtun opted for his loud brown checkered suit. Lugovoy opted for his loud brown checkered suit. Kovtun wore the tackiest silvery metallic suit imaginable, made of the finest polyester, and with both men accentuating the look, their look with brightly coloured shirts, garish ties, day glow socks, and wrist jangling assortment of gold chunky chains, bracelets, and sovereign rings. Their subtle attire was so shocking and eye-wateringly gaudy that it caused the hotel staff to chuckle. With the hotel manager, Goran Grigo, later commenting, the colours didn't match, the suits were either too big or too small, they just didn't look like people who were used to wearing suits. They looked like, I think the expression is, like a donkey with a saddle. that's a great phrase. So they came into Soho, they were wearing their kind of 1980s kind of Miami Vice suits. They got on a rickshaw and they decided to have a lovely tour around Soho. And that was before their first failed attempted murder of Alexander Litvinenko. Fantastic. Apparently, one of them is like very high up in the Russian parliament at the moment. And I believe he has, I can't remember which one it was, but I believe he has a TV series on in Russia called Assassins. Because apparently he's an expert. Which we know is not true. So if we're strolling down, we've just crossed Old Compton Street at the moment. Wasabi is on our left-hand side. And if we just go past that on the left-hand side, you will see a green building, 48 Dean Street, which is called Rosa's Thai. You probably think, oh, we haven't been to a Thai restaurant before on Murder Mile. Well, we have. This is going to take us right back to episode 2. I know, all those years ago. So that is episode 2, that's 48 Dean Street, back to episode 2, the double murder at the Bus Stop Club, it was called. That building, when was this? This was back, I haven't written down the date, but this was back in the late 50s, early, I think it was early 60s, if I remember correctly. 37-year-old Antonio Benedetto Mella, known locally as Big Tony. This was originally a club called the Bus Stop. They'd taken it over. They hadn't bothered to change the name. It was a clip joint, which meant that downstairs in the basement, it was meant to be sexy ladies doing dancing, getting naked, lots of music, lots of drink. The problem was they hadn't got an entertainment license. They hadn't got a sex club license, which is the new thing that apparently you have to have now. They hadn't got an alcohol license. They hadn't got a music license. So they couldn't do any of that. So basically young men, it still happens today at clip joints, young men lured in for overpriced drinks, no music, no entertainment, no nudie ladies, which is a real shame. Eva doesn't let me look at things like that. Apparently I'm only allowed to have eyes for her, which is right enough. That was their club. Apparently there was a falling out between Big Tony and Alfred Melville, who was his partner. Alfred had loaned him 300 quid, which was a good couple of £1,000 by that point. Bit of a falling out between them. Big Tony decided not to pay back that £300. He was mocking Alfred Melville, saying, I'm not going to pay you back. Who the F do you think you are? On that date, on the first floor, that was kind of their office, Alfred Melville pulled out his gun, aimed it at Big Tony, shot him 3 times in the back. He knew there was going to be retribution from this because obviously Big Tony was a gangster. Turned around, put the gun under his chin, blew his own brains out. Big Tony staggered from the first floor, so it's kind of the white building above Rosa, staggered out the blue door on the left-hand side and basically staggered down the street, down Dean Street. And if you look 2 doors down past the French House and past Le Relais de Venise, a restaurant that I've never been to before, but I do enjoy doing my Murder Mile walks and finish them outside there. He literally collapsed just on the corner of Romilly Street and Dean Street. And there's a little gutter there, and that's where his blood flowed down that gutter. Lovely, lovely. That's a great story. Immediately next to Rosa's, you will see the French House. The French House is 49 Dean Street, a place we've been to, or a place we've visited a couple of times before. French House it used to be called the York Minster. It's now called the French House. It's got quite an interesting history. It was originally a German-owned pub called the Wine House in 1910. The French House got its name because Charles de Gaulle used it as the base of operations during World War II. De Gaulle reportedly wrote his rallying speech in the bar with the lines, "France has lost the battle, but France has not lost the war." Yeah, whatever. It is also populated by the painter Lucien Freud, and Sylvia Plath would go in there, do a lot of singing as well. Apparently Dylan Thomas, the famous poet, wrote the first draft of his drama Under Milk Wood, and he left it under one of the chairs in there after he'd been there on an all-day bender. Lovely jovely, we've all been there. Oh, and if you know English music, the French House is also co-owned by Suggs from Madness. Ooh, exciting. If you're not from Britain, you're probably thinking, who the hell is Suggs? Who the hell is Madness? But we've been to this location before. One of the last places that William Raven was seen. So this was Thursday the 15th of October 1943, the last sighting of William Raven. That evening, He'd been in good spirits, apparently. You know, if you remember, he was that kind of small, elegant gentleman. Worked for an outfitters over on Regent Street. It was wartime. He was an openly homosexual gentleman, which was quite a brave thing to do, especially in that era. But do you know what? He's in Soho. It's a homosexual place. So, do you know, he could get, this is why he was there. He could kind of blend in. And the pub was kind of very well known as kind of a gay pickup point, especially for sailors, servicemen in that era. Do you know, you couldn't be a gay man in the armed services during World War II, but there were certain pubs that you could go to, and one of them was the York Minster at 49 Dean Street, now known as the French House. Apparently that evening, he'd had a couple of bevvies. He'd met up with a friend of his who we only know as George, who apparently was plump and small with a face caked with a thick white powder. The men met for drinks. It was wartime, and they met up with a couple of squaddies. These squaddies, two scruffy Canadian soldiers by the name of Henry Smith and George Brinicum. Apparently this is what William Raven liked. He liked kind of, you know, scruffy kind of ne'er-do-wells. You know, the exact opposite of him. They met up, they had a couple of drinks. They went back to his flat, which was over just at the back of Baker Street. And that's where the murder happened. It was a murder and a robbery. And if you remember that episode, it was weird because they stole his underpants and some socks. Do you know, they didn't steal much. They stole some shoes and I think some trousers as well. And it seemed to be like the theft for need as opposed to greed. Do you know, apparently they'd been absconding for a couple of days and that's all they had left. They needed new, fresh trousers. And that was the last time that William Raven was seen alive. We're coming near the end now. Cool, thank God, because I need to have a swig of Diet Coke. If we scroll a little bit further, you will see Romilly Street on the left-hand side, and just on the corner of Romilly Street and Dean Street, you will see the Golden Lion Pub. We were back there, I think that was episodes maybe 10 and 11, the Dennis Nielsen episode. That's 51 Dean Street. It was there that Dennis Nielsen met Paul Nobbs. This was actually Monday, the 23rd of November, 1981. It was Dennis Nielsen's birthday. He'd taken half day off work. He worked at the job centre around the corner. He came here and he was like, I'm going to celebrate and have a couple of drinks. Paul Nobbs apparently was a student at the university around the corner. He was like, oh, do you know, I can't be asked with going to college today. I've got a hangover. I'll just go and have a pint. Went into the Golden Lion, met Dennis Nielsen. And that's where a little relationship between them started. If you go back to that episode, they had a couple of pints together, had some fun, went back to Dennis's flat at 23C Cranley Gardens. The two of them had sex, and that's where Dennis Nielsen strangled him. But Paul Nobbs was rescued by Bleep the dog. If you want to know more, check out that episode. I think that is entitled Dennis Nielsen and the Sleeping Bag of Death. I moved out of the way then because there are some ladies walking past who don't seem to understand volume. They're right next to each other, but they had to shout to each other, and they're literally a couple of inches apart. I am currently standing outside 56 Dean Street at the moment, which is a white building on the right-hand side. So immediately opposite Romilly Street, right-hand side, it's the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital registered offices. This again isn't a murder one, but it's one of these crimes that I just thought we flag up because it's Soho based. Nurse Ian Wingrove, 32, fondled two patients during a sexual health checkups and has been kicked out of the profession. Nurse Wingrove was jailed for 2 years in June. This was 2014. After he was convicted of carrying out the attacks on patients who had no known symptoms for any infections. One of his victims was from the USA and didn't report the assault for months because he thought that's just how checkups are done in the UK. 9th of December 2013, in this building right here, this was his office, a gentleman who is only being referred to as Patient A alleged that Nurse Wingrove masturbated the patient's penis until it was erect and he ejaculated. I had to slow that down then and change my speed because a young child was walking past. This happens a lot when I do my murder mile walks. that I will be, when I'm about to say something really horrific, normally a child will walk past. Also, there was another patient, 7th of November 2014. This was actually in a different office just up the road, but still on Dean Street. 24th of May 2014, patient B was asked by Nurse Ian to remove his trousers and his underwear, and then Nurse Ian proceeded to stroke the man's penis and pull his foreskin, which made him erect, stating, "Ooh, lots of guys are getting hard for me today." Apparently he was struck off, but he was allowed to continue treating patients until obviously the inquest happened at Colchester General Hospital, where he, after that he was jailed. He was convicted of two sexual offences. What does it say here? It doesn't say how long he was... No, he was just struck off. It doesn't say that he was sent to prison for any point. Which is interesting. You would think that given the fact that that is a sexual assault, he would be sent to prison. No. He was convicted at trial of two sexual assaults, but it doesn't say how long for. Haven't got it on my notes. Sorry about that. Anyway, that brings us to the corner of Dean Street and Shaftesbury Avenue. God, that was a bit of a damp squib, that last story. Maybe I shouldn't have done that one. We're on the corner of Dean Street and Shaftesbury Avenue. I think it's just because I'm tired. I haven't had my coffee. My brain's not fully working. Corner of Dean Street and Shaftesbury Avenue, and just in front of us is actually the former bank, as mentioned in the previous episode, of Carmel and Schlitt, where John Esmond Murphy committed a robbery under... whilst he was bamboozled by epilepsy, apparently. But that is the end of this episode. Oh, I'm exhausted. Hope you enjoyed that. Next week, we'll be the last one. We will do Frith Street, which is the street immediately to kind of my left, running parallel. You'll hear lots of stories that you may have heard before, but loads of other stories that, you know, you definitely haven't heard before, because you know what? I haven't heard of them. After that episode, we will go back to our kind of usual setting. That will be 10 to 15 regular Murder Mile episodes. As you can appreciate, it takes a long time to research these episodes. What I do is I spend a lot of time trying to get all the details and the facts right. Unlike, I'm going to be honest about this, some podcasts I know, when they're meeting up to see each other, they've admitted to me they do their research on the bus to meet each other. So if they're on the bus for half an hour, you're listening to an episode that has taken them half an hour to research. I think your time is worth more than that. Definitely, isn't it? You really deserve the best, which is why I try and push out all the best and make sure you get the best episodes possible. And even if you don't enjoy Meander Mile, at least it's a little bit of entertainment just, you know, in the interim. Anyway, hope you enjoyed that. That was a bit of fun. I will see you next week for Meander Mile episode 7. Have yourself a good week. Stay safe. Be good. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.